ces compromis, je le dis très clairement, ne se feront pas au prix de l'ambition européenne. Pas pour le principe, mais parce que nous sommes face à une crise qui est inédite sur le plan sanitaire, économique et social. Parce que nos pays en ont besoin et l'unité de l'Europe en a besoin.
Realistically, debt doesn't seem to really be an issue anymore. And the reason why is that we've got into the habit of printing money whenever there's a problem. And we keep printing money. And everybody keeps printing money.
Reactions to the rescue plan have been positive, like in the case of debt-ridden Italy.
Presidente, onorevoli senatrici, onorevoli senatori.
Where the money from the EU recovery plan can or cannot be applied is also one mired in controversy. COVID-19 may have affected many industries like tourism, but perhaps the post-COVID period will usher in a new era of economic hope.
Back in the studio with Mick Lawless, member of the European Parliament. Mick, our final question to you. The 2008 financial crisis resulted in the Eurozone debt crisis of over 1 trillion euros that was needed in bailout funds. Top countries like Greece, France, Italy, and Spain, they accrued massive debts. These countries are still the highest risk countries, even before the pandemic hit. Why were they not able to make the strides necessary to improve economically, do you think? And now they are facing a more severe downturn due to the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, look, political philosophies vary. And in my opinion, the European Union made a huge mistake in how it dealt with the banking crisis. This was a crisis that was created by nobody else but the financial institutions. And the financial institutions did not suffer from the crisis. They were bailed out, they came out of it fine, and they're all doing grand, thank you very much. But lots of people have suffered dramatically from it and haven't recovered from it. Those countries were amalgamated into the European Union overnight. There was two guiding principles that made that happen. Number one, they wanted a cheap pool of labour from Eastern Europe to be able to supply mainly seasonal work and menial labour tasks in Western developed Europe. Number two, they wanted many of those countries, especially those that were close to the Russian border, they wanted to get them into NATO.
All right. We want to thank Mick Lawless, European Parliament member, for his thoughts here. It's time now for an in-depth section. It's actually a good time to go back to when the Eurozone debt crisis broke out and what it was. Well, amid the 2008 financial crisis, many Eurozone countries were unable to control their debts due to exposure to the banks. And this became known as the Eurozone debt crisis. Many countries needed bailouts. Countries like Greece, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal. The EU and IMF agreed to a 750 billion euro or $1 trillion for these crisis-hit Eurozone countries. Now, fast forward to the year 2020. How did the $1 trillion bailout actually fare out? Well, the ratio of government debt to GDP, as you can see here, was 176.6%. That really put into question why the bailout didn't help or worse yet, where the money went. And here we are, the year 2021. Europe is in the throes of a COVID-19 pandemic, the third to have hit. And we're seeing a repeat of another bailout. The figure? Did I hear $1 trillion? $2 trillion? No, the amount, $2.2 trillion or 1.85 trillion euros, backed by a joint debt. Now here, the countries getting the first batch of the bailout money. You can see Italy, Spain, and France with the various amounts. And finally, the big question is whether this huge bailout money will work or not. Well, let's take a look at the map of Europe that's color-coded over here. The countries in green have national debts below 100 billion euros, yellow to be below 1 trillion euros, and the ones in red above 1 trillion euros. So there you can see whether this actually worked or not. In closing, I could talk about how badly some EU countries are doing economically and how the EU and the ECB, the European Central Bank, will come to the rescue again. I mean, the effort will be made to save these economies. I mean, there can't be any other way, can it? To save the Euro project, that's the goal. One would think the EU would do everything it can to not lose any business. Well, if that's the case, then why does it go and sanction China? Or why does it sanction Iran or Russia? I mean, in the case of Iran, it could do business with Iran. It could do a lot of business with Iran. It's supposed to do it due to the JCPOA, but it's not. Russia, yes, it does do business with Russia, but it goes ahead and sanctions its officials, including China. Furthermore, talk about Russia. Why doesn't it, or didn't it use the Russian Sputnik V vaccine? It's known to be effective. I mean, the rollout in the EU was very slow. The economy could have been rolling right now a lot more than it is. I mean, shouldn't human lives be more important than politics? Well, that does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thanks so much for tuning in. From Mikove Tahwai, the entire team is goodbye until next week.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, Close-up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Are you afraid of snakes? Or spiders? I hope your answer is negative, because today I'm going to visit the spider-tailed horned viper. The spider-tailed horned viper is a unique species of horned viper endemic to western Iran in Ilam province. The species, like other species of horned vipers, have structures above its eyes, which gives it a horn-like view. The spider-tailed horned viper has a unique tail that has a bulb-like end that is bordered by long drooping scales that give it the appearance of a spider. The tail tip is waved around and used to lure prey, especially birds. The amazing movements of the tail make it look like a moving spider, so that when an animal tries to attack the so-called spider, the poor animal itself becomes the prey in a blink of an eye. I am now in Ilam province, in the habitat of the spider-tailed horned viper. Ilam is located in the heart of Zagros mountain range. 25 beautiful species of snakes, as well as 5 amazing species of vipers inhabit in this region. Among them is the spider-tailed horned viper, which is unique and lesser known to the public, which I've decided to visit it. One of the region's conservation officers had told me that seeing this viper is quite hard and I have to be patient or maybe lucky to spot one. Well, I'm patient for sure, and I hope I'm lucky. Okay, this large stone is an ideal place for them. The spider-tailed horned viper usually lives near these stones. We have to stay silent and motionless. I have to wait. This is one of the most amazing scenes I've ever seen in whole of my life. This is not a spider. It's the strange tail of the viper. It's orangish in color. Exactly looks like a spider with its scales around. Well, the spider-tailed horn viper of our story is waiting for a poor, defenseless animal, which is after a delicious spider, so that it could trap the animal just with a leap. Tonight, better leave here calmly and don't bother the hunting adventure of this wonderful viper. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Shortly after taking office as South Vietnam's president in 1955, pro-American Ngo Dinh Diem began a crackdown on suspected members of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition of the North. The Cold War was in full swing, and the United States, which was concerned about a rise in communism, gradually ramped up its military presence in Vietnam. Washington finally found the excuse to justify a war in the region following an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1963 when two U.S. destroyers were targeted by a torpedo attack by the North Vietnamese forces. The U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. The conflict that ensued has been regarded as one of the bloodiest wars the U.S. has ever been involved in. American troops resorted to using warfares, including napalm and chemical toxins, to confront their enemy. Perhaps the most notorious was a chemical substance called Agent Orange that was used during Operation Ranch Hand to defoliate jungles to uncover Vietnamese troops and destroy crops between 1961 and 1971. The substance contained dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals known to man and has been linked to severe birth defects, cancers, and mental and physical disabilities.
I mean, this is, you have to understand that America has a different standard for the rest of the world than it does at home. At home, America adheres to fairly high level standards when it comes to herbicides, for example, of which Agent Orange is one. But when it comes to the poor nations of the world, such as Laos or Cambodia, a completely different standard applies.
The U.S. failure in the war and its atrocities in terms of the number of civilian deaths and the use of chemical weapons has tarnished America's image at home and abroad to date. The U.S. rained down some 600,000 gallons of herbicides on the neutral nation of Laos and roughly 19 million gallons of such chemicals in Vietnam. The chemicals were so potent that even American troops got a taste of their detrimental effects. After 14 years of legal dispute, the U.S. Congress passed the Orange Agent Act in 1991 to compensate American veterans of the Vietnam War who were exposed to the toxin. But it wasn't until the year 2000 that Washington started to admit responsibility for what the people of Vietnam and Laos have been going through. Washington kicked off a 10-year project to decontaminate swathes of Vietnamese land from the herbicide in 2019, but stopped short of awarding compensation to the families of the victims. There's also no mention of U.S. chemical attacks on neutral Laos during the war. Even after the American military acknowledged the attacks, a former American commander denied all knowledge about the use of dioxin there.
The Laos was a country that was caught in the middle of the Indo-Chinese War. The U.S. Was absolutely indiscriminate in its use of Agent Orange and other weapons of war against the population. It never apologized. It never had any second thoughts. As far as the U.S. was concerned, it was just a collateral damage. So the U.S. has never made good on that. It's never made good on the enormous damage that was done to Cambodia, or certainly the incredible bloodshed that was imposed on Vietnam.
The Vietnam War ended long ago, but not for thousands of people living in Vietnam and Laos who are still being haunted by its effects.
The annual United States Report on Global Human Rights Practices looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, as part of its global analysis on almost 200 nations. In the first such report of the Biden administration, the U.S. reaffirmed the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights and the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is while Washington has refused to slam the Israeli regime for its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories, as well as other crimes. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets. That is why the UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Also, according to human rights groups, acts of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property are a daily occurrence throughout the occupied West Bank. Additionally, Israel holds more than 7,000 Palestinians in its jails. Most of the prisoners are being held with no indictment or trial under a controversial policy known as administrative detention.
Well, in the first place, the U.S. lacks the moral authority to talk about human rights in any country outside of its own boundaries. Inside the U.S., there is systemic racism against people of color and against people of indigenous origin. And this has been going on for 400 years inside what is now the United States. Their record has been terrible. And to just a couple of days ago, the trial of the police man who killed George Floyd is taking place. So the U.S. has no moral authority whatsoever.
The Israeli regime's crimes seem to have no end, and the international community only condemns the regime's atrocities in words. This is while Israel is violating international law. The Golan Heights were part of Syria until 1967, when the Israeli regime captured most of the area during the Six-Day War. In 1973, Egypt and Syria launched a war against the Israeli regime in an effort to recapture the occupied territories. However, with Washington's help, Israel managed to retain control over the territory it occupied before. Then in 1981, Israel declared its unilaterally annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights in order to extend its own boundaries to cover the captured territories. In response, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 497, and condemned the annexation of Syrian territory. The Council declared the annexation a violation of international law. Meanwhile, Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. The Golan Heights territory is strategically important due to its military value. It is also a strategic asset due to its water resources and fertile land. In a relatively parched region of the world, control over the Golan's water supplies is invaluable. The Golan Heights may also have oil. Exploratory drilling suggests that the territory's reservoirs could potentially yield billions of barrels of oil. The annual United States Report on Global Human Rights Practices also reaffirmed Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the U.S. recognized in 2019. In March 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a decree recognizing Israeli sovereignty over Golan during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. The Syrian government denounced Washington's recognition of Israeli claims over the Golan Heights as a blatant attack on the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Over the past decades, Israel has built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Indeed, they are illegal, and nothing that the U.S. says or does can turn a crime into a legal act. Except for the USA, the entire world recognizes that the Golan Heights are part of the sovereign territory of Syria, and someday Syria will regain control of the Golan Heights.
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life.
So you'd want to get him up out of there.
The high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month. During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody. The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and 5 times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave patrols that were formed centuries ago. Such patrols located and forcefully returned enslaved people who had escaped.
The first reason for police to begin with to exist in the United States were to catch enslaved people who liberated themselves from their owners who fled to the north. And that's why you'll see the first badges of the police from the 1800s said the words slave patrol, because that was one of their first jobs, to catch liberated enslaved peoples who were running to the north for freedom, for economic opportunity. That's the roots of policing in the United States, and we have to contend with that in order to deal with this.
The federal government banned the use of racist regulations at the state and local level many decades ago. Yet, ethnic minorities are subject to discrimination and profiling. Former U.S. President Donald Trump gained notoriety for fueling racial tensions and discrimination through provocative comments and stances. His successor, Joe Biden, has been an outspoken critic of racial injustice. But it remains to be seen whether he can truly lead the U.S. towards a less racially discriminative future.
Iran and China have signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed by the foreign ministers of the two countries in Tehran. The agreement includes political, strategic, and economic cooperation over the next 25 years. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as its banking and telecom sectors. The pact has been in works since 2016 when President Xi Jinping became the first Chinese leader to visit the Iranian capital in over a decade. Many believe that the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing up against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
Apart from this bilateral perspective, I think this signed agreement could be considered as a response, in a sense, in order to broaden the scope of the options that Iran has in its foreign policy. Knowing the fact that Iran has been practicing negotiations with the Western side, and then after all these years, and after JCPOA was signed and sealed, and later on was kind of not effective for Iranian signatory of the deal, now there is this consensus among Iranian politicians that they should broaden the scope of their international relations, and obviously China is going to be one of the most powerful options to be taken into consideration.
The agreement drew an outright reaction from Washington.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the remarks in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. In response, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said the signing of the Iran and China Strategic Partnership Roadmap is part of the active resistance policy. Shamkhani said the world isn't just the West, noting, however, that Biden's concern is justified as a flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East will accelerate the U.S. decline.
Well, I think the agreement that we are currently discussing could kind of pave the way for the U.S. hegemony to be broken, at least in Asia. And this is quite against the strategies that the United States is following in order to, let's say, increase its hegemonic power, specifically in Asia and particularly in the Middle East. So this particular framework could kind of, let's say, put the United States in a rather isolated situation. And could, of course, put China and Iran in a better situation.
Iran's closer cooperation with China, on one hand, can help Tehran shore up its economy against the impacts of the U.S. sanctions. On the other hand, the Tehran-Beijing alliance may be seen as a challenge to President Biden's China policy. This as the two major economic powers have been at odds over a string of issues, including trade, with each side having imposed tariffs worth of hundreds of billions of dollars on other side's goods. The stalemate has prompted China to increase its imports of Iranian oil to around 1 million barrels a day, eroding U.S. leverage. Many believe that China's new partnership with Iran is not a full alliance, but enough to undermine U.S. sanctions and rock the global status quo.
Whether we call it a strategic partnership or alliance or whatever you name it, the thing is that the very tangible consequence of this, let's say, new deal is that the world has has to come to this realization that the calculations are, let's say, rapidly changing. And this, in this recent situation, the United States and its Western partners are not going to be able to consider themselves as the only powers and as the only superpowers of the world with respect to the new emerging powers and with respect to great economic powers that are emerging in Asia. And this is going to definitely change the context, not only in the Middle East and not only in Asia, but also all over the world. And new line of calculations are going to be met for the years down the road.
This as Washington has expressed eagerness to enter stalled talks with Tehran to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out Washington from the agreement, claiming Tehran violated it. This as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has on multiple occasions reiterated Tehran's full compliance with the international accord. The Trump administration went even further by imposing a signature maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. All in all, it seems that Iran and China can establish an economic bloc if Tehran-Beijing Comprehensive Partnership Agreement expands to other countries in Asia and through that confront the U.S. unilateralism.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. Domestic markets and natural resources.
One is the domestic market capacity. In other words, Iranian producers have an 80 million market at their disposal. This means that every producer is also a consumer. Overall, an 80 million market in a big country is available to Iranian producers, and this is an important opportunity in itself. Another important capacity is natural resources, some of which, but not all, we are using today, but we use them in the raw form. These resources include oil and gas. They are being consumed in the raw form, while they could be used in much better ways in order to create value added. Other examples include agricultural lands, pastures, and forests, which are great sources of wealth available to the Iranian nation. We have a good rank in the world in terms of underground minerals such as oil and gas, zinc, copper, iron ore, and the like. Our rank ranges from the first and second to ninth. We have such a great natural resources. Well, this is a very important capacity.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Besides, important infrastructure has been built in the last 30 years, which did not exist before. Dams, power plants, rail and road transportation, and many other infrastructure. Well, if a country with such characteristics and with all these capacities formulates good economic plans, and if it benefits from efficient management, which is strong and capable of resolving the people's issues, which cares about the people and which is anti-corruption, later on, I will expand on the characteristics of such a manager in my discussion about elections, then that country will turn into an economically advanced country resistant against all sanctions. This does not mean that the sanctions will be lifted. Rather, it means that it does not matter if they are lifted or not. When there is a thriving and progressive economy, others will need that economy, and in such circumstances, sanctions will not make any sense.
The necessity for the people to show their cooperation.
Another point which is good to be discussed on the economic matters of the country is that eliminating the problems requires the people's cooperation. If the people enter any area, that area will surely improve. This has been the case until now. Whenever the people entered any area, that area improved.
Around the World with Reporters.
Most government hospitals have remained largely empty because of a nationwide strike action by resident doctors who constitute a large percentage of medical doctors in government hospitals in Nigeria. Consultancy rooms have remained empty because of the absence of medical doctors to attend to patients. Doctors Union officials said they are tired of the government failing to live up to its promises of settling their salaries and other benefits on time. Representatives of the Nigerian government met with labor leaders behind closed doors in a last-minute effort to avert the strike, but apparently the meeting ended in a deadlock. The government appealed to the doctors to consider the damage their withdrawal of services will cause to Nigeria's health system. But the resident doctors said the government should keep its several promises. This strike is coming at a challenging period, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, with only about 800,000 Nigerians vaccinated in a country with a population of close to 200 million. Nigeria has 163,000 COVID-19 cases, out of which 2,038 people have died so far. The doctors' union said all the resident doctors at the COVID-19 centers have joined the strike and withdrew their services. This doctors' strike is in progress just when the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is receiving treatment in a London hospital. According to union officials, close to 16,000 resident doctors are participating in this strike, which is indefinite. Most of the resident doctors are specialists who provide important healthcare services, especially in emergency wards. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Thank you.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for a way to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The West and Russia are on a collision course again over Ukraine. The Kremlin has warned the Western military alliance NATO that any deployment of troops along the Ukrainian border with Russia would deteriorate the situation further. Moscow says it would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security if the U.S.-led NATO sends troops in support of Ukraine. That, a day after the Ukrainian president accused Russia of building up troops along the border amid renewed clashes between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian militias. Russia says its military presence on the border is not meant to threaten Ukraine. Moscow's response came after the U.S. warned last week against what it called Russian intimidation and pledged to stand by Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have had a conflict centered on Crimea and Donbas regions since 2014. Tensions surfaced with Kiev and Moscow recently trading blame for a spike in violence in eastern Ukraine. In a recent meeting, NATO ambassadors condemned what they called Moscow's military buildup near Ukraine. However, the Russia foreign minister says the U.S.-led anti-Russia NATO campaign will ultimately destroy Ukraine.
Judging by the information published by the media, the majority of Ukrainian military forces understand the fatality of any actions leading to a hot conflict. I very much hope that they will not be incited by politicians, who in turn will be incited by the West, led by the United States.
The U.S. and European leaders are losing no time to denounce and threaten Russia citing Ukraine. Tensions have been running high ever since Ukraine's Crimea region re-entered into Russia following a referendum. Since then, NATO has been expanding its Eastern Front. The United States missile systems in Romania and Poland, as well as American soldiers and military hardware in the region, are part of the military alliance game plan. Latvia and Lithuania are among destinations where NATO members have been sending their troops and weaponries. The reason? They lie right along the border with Russia. Apart from military deployments near Russia's borders, the West has imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Kremlin. It seems the continued pressure on Russia could plunge the two sides into another Cold War era and throw them and their allies into yet another vicious arms race.
As United States President Joe Biden keeps failing to honor his campaign promise to quickly undo the damage wrought by his predecessor on relations with Iran, Washington is grappling with the reality that it's now a very different geopolitical world. The just-signed $400 billion, 25-year Iran-China pact, which China's foreign minister called permanent, has been received with shock and awe across the Beltway. Washington's long-standing effort to totally isolate and blockade Iran has formally failed, while China's new ally provides a major energy obstacle to the Pentagon's militaristic pivot to Asia policy.
The foreign policy of the United States really does not change under Democrats or Republicans very much. So there's agreement in that area of the oligarchy on foreign policy. And foreign policy really is based on controlling basically the world.
The Economic and Security Alliance worsens the leverage of the United States, but they have repeatedly undermined their own bargaining position. In 2018, the United States illegally and unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program, and then began reimposing crippling economic sanctions designed to force Iran to renegotiate. Tehran insists compliance with the original pact is the only way forward and reiterated that the deal is still on the table if Biden returns the U.S. into compliance.
What should he do with Iran is he should get back into the agreement that Obama made, and we should be working with them to relieve the sanctions. They've actually done everything that the United States required of them. It's the foreign policy of the United States is totally immoral. So it's immoral towards Iran as it is in many other places.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani recently said that the lack of knowledge about Iran from American officials is ridiculous. Many analysts have been dumbfounded by the formal alliance. It's what many Americans now call woke, as it's between two nations of different colors, ethnicities, cultures, and cosmologies. Top American media is saying the next few weeks are make or break for the JCPOA, at least until September. The Biden administration is reportedly scrambling to present a new offer to Tehran as soon as next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As the Yemeni army is pushing ahead with its offensive to liberate the city of Marib from Saudi-backed forces, Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of the southern and eastern Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition.
Many of the free people in southern Yemen stand beside their country in groups and parties, but they face severe oppression from the forces of the coalition in southern regions, which confirms the ugliness of the crimes committed by the coalition against Yemenis. All Yemenis should be working together on a comprehensive plan to liberate all governorates after the liberation of Marib.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war in Yemen, eastern and western tribes played a key role in supporting the Yemeni army with weapons, money, and fighters. The participants say the tribes devoted their efforts to expel the foreign presence from their country.
The southern and eastern Yemeni tribes have many honorable stances, whether by spreading culture and awareness or supporting the political position inside and outside Yemen. They are also supporting the fronts of confrontation with weapons, men, money, and sending food convoys to the fighters on all fronts. The tribes are seeking to expel the foreign occupation from the country.
The Yemeni army has recently intensified its operations to liberate Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. A move which considered as the first step forward for liberating the rest of the country.
Yemenis agree that the liberation of the country will not succeed without the tribes backing the army, since the tribes themselves refuse the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released